Hi, good evening. I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Consider This. Tonight we have the author of The Billionaire Raj, James Crabtree. He's associate professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, and also a senior fellow at the Center on Asia and Globalization. Author of many other books, including Connected People, Rethinking Broadband Britain. Thank you so much, James, for being with me today. I'd like to begin with the fact that you're located in Singapore, and then when you look up north, as it were, you see Malaysia. And I wonder, the Malaysian story over the last year in particular, does it interest you? What do you see happening that sort of conforms with or goes against your own sense of the world and the way economies work and societies operate?
So I wrote a book about India, which was about the rise of the super rich and crony capitalism. And there's quite a lot of overlap between the Malaysia story and the India story. So in India, in 2014, Prime Minister Narendra Modi was elected after a series of corruption scandals on a promise to clean up the country. In 2018, something very similar happened in Malaysia, where you'd had a roiling corruption scandal in 1MDB and the old government being thrown out in what I think was a very optimistic, very positive development for the country. And now both of these governments are grappling with how to deliver on the hopes that the people gave to them. You know, are they going to be able to clean up politics and reorganize their respective economies in order to make their countries less corrupt and more prosperous?
You know, what's interesting, because the Indian story is that we have it refracted through issues like the Kashmir problem, the Jammu and Kashmir problem of late, but also the rise of Hindu nationalism. But we'll put that aside for a while. I want to ask you specifically about your book and the choice of, as it were, aperture. Why did you choose billionaires as a way, entry point to understanding India? And I did some Googling around for some factoids about billionaires. I don't know, something about 18 new billionaires in 2018, coming up to about 138 billionaires as well, but that still pales in comparison to China's 300 or 300 more, if you include Hong Kong, and of course the US phenomenal amount of, I think it's the largest number of billionaires in the world. Why billionaires as a way to understand India?
Well, so people are fascinated by the super rich, and I became fascinated by the super rich in India. I lived there for 5 years between 2011 and 2016. I lived in Mumbai, the financial capital where most of the billionaires live, and I just became obsessed with the lives of the Indian super rich and the vast amounts of money that were being created. So the richest man, not just in India, but in Asia, is an Indian tycoon called Mukesh Ambani. He lives in an enormous residential skyscraper, the billion-dollar home.
That's the way to describe it, absolutely.
The famous billion-dollar home in Mumbai. But just in general, India, as Malaysia has been creating a huge amount of wealth at the very pinnacle of its society. This is the region of the crazy rich Asians. And so I was interested in Indian tycoons, but I was also interested in how it was that they made their money. Had they done it the right way or the wrong way? And what were the consequences of that for Indians' economy and also for its society? Was it becoming less or more unequal?
Is there a wrong way to become a billionaire? I know on the list of countries, the top 15 countries of billionaires there, we have Russia. And because Russia, of course, is always said to be made up. I mean, the billionaires there are said to be oligarchs, and they seem to have, you know, somehow made some sort of deal when they were transfers of assets from the state to the private sector and so on and so forth. Is there a wrong way to become a billionaire? Is it a dog-eat-dog world where some people just take the advantage when they see it and then become rich?
Well, I think you have two different types. You've got, in a sense, what some people call the good billionaires, who are those who, let's take the Indian software entrepreneurs who built great companies, sold products on global markets, made an absolute fortune, and there's nothing particularly wrong with that. But then there were also a large number of billionaires in India, but also here in Southeast Asia, who made their money through their, at least in part, through their connections to the government by getting special favors, special concessions. So I have no particular problem with people making money honestly, but there were plenty of people who were making money because they were getting favors from friends in high places.
Right, this would be rent-seeking activity and so on. So what for you is the downside? If you put aside the morality of it, of getting favors. Well, what does it do to the economy when you have the rich becoming rich in this particular way?
Well, for a start, it tends to mean that you get corruption scandals like 1MDB in Malaysia, or the huge number of scams, they call them multi-billion dollar scams, that preceded Narendra Modi's election, the telecom scandal, the coal scandal, the iron ore scandal. But more than that, it tends to lead to misdirected investment. So if you think about India, even up to today, but over the last decade, there have been a lot of money borrowed from banks that was misspent in projects that probably wouldn't have gone ahead if it had better governance. And exactly the same was true here in Malaysia and in Southeast Asia in the run-up to the Asian financial crisis of the mid to late 1990s, where you had a lot of speculative investment going into areas like property and infrastructure that didn't really need to be built, that were being built because of corruption and cronyism. And so it isn't just that you have corruption scandals, it's that you have a lot of productive capital that could be used to build useful things going into things which aren't useful.
Is it a failure of our moral fiber? I mean, these countries that demonstrate precisely the kind of scenarios that you just sketched out for us, or is it a question of institutional failure, that we don't have the democratic institutions to enforce good governance and so on and so forth?
Well, I suppose it's a bit of both, but I think the second way is much the most useful way of looking about it. This isn't about India or Malaysia having a peculiar problem. In actual fact, this is almost a universal phenomenon. In the book, I talk about America in the late 19th century, the American Gilded Age, the age of the robber baron tycoons and corrupt urban politics, where you had billionaires or millionaires then who were at least as greedy and corrupt as those that have been the worst of India, and politicians of much the same ilk. And almost any country that has gone through this early stage of industrialization, whether it was Britain in the early 19th century, America in the late 19th century, Korea in the 1960s, Southeast Asia, or now India and South Asia today, a lot of them go through this stage. And what you need are good quality public institutions to manage this, and that tends to be the problem, that your governments are not good enough at managing these complicated processes of economic development.
Okay, we'll take a short break. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned to consider this. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, James Crabtree. He's the author of The Billionaire Raj. Let's go back to India. Your choice of looking at billionaires, the way to understand where India is, it used to be the story of the Indian middle class. We used to hear so much about this expanding middle class that was, going to change the way India operated. Why has that story of the middle class sort of disappeared, or has it disappeared from view?
So a country like Malaysia is increasingly a real, genuine middle class economy. India hasn't really got there yet. So you think about India, it's a country of 1.3 or more billion people. And the middle class, as we would understand it, as people in the rich world would understand the middle class, as in you own a car, you went to college, you have savings, that population is tiny in India. It's probably 15 to 20 million people only. So it's much, much smaller than you think. So all of these big global companies that go into India expecting to find this great middle class that has credit cards and is able to spend lots of money on fancy Japanese pharmaceuticals or expensive cars end up losing a lot of money because the middle class population isn't there yet. The optimistic thing, though, is that that middle class population is going to grow hugely over the next 20 or 30 years. So India is going to add more members to the global middle class for the first time than almost any other country. But it's just a reminder that India remains, at this stage of its development, a reasonably poor country. Maybe the average person earns $2,000 as opposed to $8,000. In a country like China.
So. Right, so one of the things that, and the comparison of China, I think is a very interesting one. We'll perhaps come back to it shortly. But there was a number that used to be bandied about, 200, 300 million middle class Indians now consuming the world, buying washing machines, perhaps disrupting the global environment and ecology because of their demands as middle class people. I mean, the idea of, you know, Indians as tourists and so on, that seemed to be based on that larger number. Where have we got the numbers wrong in terms of the Indian middle class?
Well, what might be considered middle class in India and what might be considered middle class in Japan or South Korea are very different things. So when you're talking about that larger number, you're talking about maybe somebody in India who lives in a city, who owns their own home, who maybe drives a scooter, who can put their kids into inexpensive private schools at a very low cost. But you're not talking about somebody who would come close to membership of the global middle class as understood in a country like Germany. And so that's the distinction, that when Indians talk about being middle class, you're talking about people who are much more prosperous than they used to be, and who do have money to spend, but who are still very cost conscious. Maybe, you know, they're just thinking about buying their first car, maybe they don't own a car. And so the difference between that 200, 300 million people who are, in a sense, the kind of the lower emerging middle class and people who a multinational company would see as middle class is vast.
Okay. You know, it used to be also said about India, there was a discussion around India as a soft state, right? And I was wondering if you could address that. I mean, to what extent does the Indian state or the states as they are, you know, in their regional configuration, how do they contribute to the story that you have written about, the billionaires, the middle class that presumably are also there in the story, and the economy? Is the Indian state a major player in shaping the Indian economy?
Probably not as much as it should be. So India does have a lot of very smart people who work in its government and a lot of reasonably good public institutions, the central bank, the upper echelons of the court system. You know, there's good bits of government in India, but there's also a lot of problems with the way the government works. The government is in parts of the economy that it shouldn't be in. It still owns a hopeless national airline and a whole bunch of pretty terrible banks and other, you know, other companies that it probably shouldn't own. And then there are large areas where the Indian government isn't present that it really should be, in areas like basic primary school education, basic healthcare services, all sorts of areas where the state is either absent or barely functional. So I live in Singapore, and moving to Southeast Asia, I got to learn about the recent economic history of this part of the world, you know, starting with the economic development of Japan, South Korea, then through to countries like Malaysia. One of the consistent points about the successes of Southeast and East Asia was the development of high-quality public institutions. If you want to develop rapidly, move your economy up the value chain, then you need good government. And so that really is the big challenge for India. The problems that I highlight in my book, many of them were caused by regulation, government simply not being able to keep up with the changes in its system of capitalism. And so for it to prosper in the next stage, it needs much better quality public institutions.
What do you make of that early phase? I mean, that some people refer to as kind of Nehruvian socialism, that whole, you know, the Congress Party presided over for decades, of an interventionist state or a state that perhaps was going to hold global capitalism at bay, and it did so for many, many decades. What do you make of that period?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that it was a mistake. If you go back to 1945 and the end of the Second World War, you would have had three competing systems of government, or three ways of organizing your economy. You had India and some countries that were like India, which, as you say, were Nehruvian socialists. They cut themselves off from the world, heavily state-directed. You had Maoism in China. And then you had the system that was developed in Japan, which was broadly democratic and which opened itself up to the world economy. And it's perfectly clear that the Japanese system, which then migrated to Korea and Singapore and Malaysia, was vastly more successful than the Indian system. And so, in a sense, the story of India is one of arrested development. India only really began to get going again in the early 1980s through reopening in 1991, and then really powering ahead in the 2000s. And so it's opened up and begun to develop much later than China. And so that, in a sense, is why India is an economy that today is still much poorer. So there were some reasons to admire Mr. Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, not least his commitment to a multiracial, multi-ethnic society, which was religiously tolerant, which is a theme that's very important here in Malaysia. But in terms of its economic management, I mean, I think it was a mistake, and India would have been much better advised to take a different path.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is often credited as the man that kind of opened up India, right? And he was a man from the Congress Party. And that was some decades ago. Why hasn't India, in some sense, caught up with China? They're similar in terms of population size and perhaps, you know, similar problems of poverty and so on and so forth. Why have the Chinese seemed so infinitely more successful in transforming the country than India has been?
Well, India started later, for a start.
So Very much later?
China began to liberalize in the early 1980s, and India began to liberalize in the middle of the 1990s, early 1990s. So it's 10 or 15 years behind. Nonetheless, China, I think, has grown extraordinarily quickly, and India is very unlikely to match that period of 10% growth. And partly that's to do with India's political system. India is a messy democracy that is less good at managing the early stages of industrialization in the way that China has. China's very good at building expensive infrastructure, you know, bullet trains and shiny roads. And this is a pattern in East Asian development, that countries in the early stages of their development that are autocratic in nature, and so you could include Malaysia under the first Mahathir administration in that category, have in some ways a developmental advantage because they're able to put in place the building blocks of industrial development in terms of good infrastructure, in terms of exporting industries. And India has been less good at that. But the Indian political system, its democracy, has other countervailing strengths. And so I don't think India would be well advised to try and set itself up as a Chinese-style autocracy instead. I think in the long term, it might be a case that the tortoise may outpace the hare, and India may find itself being a more stable country over the medium term because it has a democratic political system as opposed to an autocracy.
Because, you know, India produced Amartya Sen, and we know some of the discussions around economic development and democracy. But do you think among the Indians that you've lived and worked with and rubbed shoulders with on a daily basis in Mumbai, there's a hankering for strong government? There's perhaps a fantasy that if India had a stronger leadership, you know, a la China, maybe in the form of Narendra Modi, nevertheless, a strong leader, you know, who could sort of, you know, take charge, that India would be so much greater.
There definitely is that hankering. I mean, India's population is understandably impatient. They want to have what China has, or what France or what Japan has. You know, they want rapid economic development, high quality public infrastructure. They want to ride on bullet trains and have their electricity made on solar farms. That's totally understandable. And yes, so there is a certain attraction of strong leadership and to some degree autocratic leadership. And so you see that under Narendra Modi at the moment, who is what in India is often called a majoritarian leader, you know, both in religious terms but also in his approach to leadership. However, you know, you have to remember that India also has rejected that kind of leadership in the past. In the 1970s, under Indira Gandhi, they had a period of near dictatorship known as the emergency, which is rightly viewed as one of the darkest periods of Indian history. And it's a very diverse country with a lot of different religious and minority groups. And so were India to transform itself into a majoritarian Hindu republic, then I think that would be very dangerous. And so I think a lot of people in India are also rightly quite worried about that impulse towards a more autocratic, more majoritarian style of government.
Okay, but because you have also mixed, not just with the hoi polloi, but with the A-listers, as it were, tell us about billionaires and their politics. They're obviously, many of them are backing Narendra Modi. Many of them are in control of Indian media, and they're enforcing their worldview. Where do they stand? Do they want Narendra Modi, who's autocratic, who's going to silence dissenting views, is going to silence minorities, including Muslims and Christians and cosmopolitans?
Well, it's interesting. So the Indian business elite is in public very loyal to Narendra Modi and won't criticize him. But in private, they'll criticize him a lot. And many of them are quite disappointed with his record as an economic reformer. I mean, what they say they want is a business-friendly agenda. They want lower taxes. They want the problems in the banking system to be sorted out. They want less bureaucracy and red tape. They want to make it easier to invest, more consistency from government. And many of them are not seeing as much of that from Modi as they thought. And also some of them, the more thoughtful members, are also slightly worried about the more illiberal turn in India's politics. They won't say this in public because, as I say, it's difficult in most countries in Asia for business people to come out and criticize the government to their face. That's true in Singapore to some degree. It's even true here in Malaysia. But the more thoughtful members of the business community, I think, also worry about what might happen if India went on a more majoritarian course. So the relationship between Mumbai, the financial capital, and Delhi, the political capital, is always a little bit tense in India.
I want to ask you if they are, as a consequence, backing or protecting to some extent India's vibrant democracy, especially in its media, because we see a lot of pressure on the media, Indian media today, as a result of Narendra Modi's recent triumphs and moving forward. And we had this shutdown in Jammu and Kashmir, which is extraordinary, to the entire province now, you know, under kind of shutdown, media blockade, right? Where do you see them eventually putting their money? Are they going to be backing the democratic forces in India? Are they going to continue to kind of hope that Narendra Modi changes?
I think it depends which media you're talking about, because there is a section of the Indian media, the television news media, which is very supportive of Modi, that is quite right-wing in its tone, and that is very nationalistic, very anti-Pakistani in particular. And so that's a lot of programs on the evening television talk show circuit fit that regard. Then you
They're
have
very noisy.
Very noisy, very shouty, obsessed with Pakistan. And so that portion of the media is very enthusiastic about Narendra Modi and sees him as a strong national leader that you can get behind. There's also a more critical, liberal, somewhat left-wing bent media, particularly the old print media in Delhi, and they're much more worried. But they're, I mean, in a sense, this is part of a wider story that the old secular liberal elite that somebody like Prime Minister Nehru represented half a century ago are in retreat in India, and Narendra Modi and his supporters, who are neither secular nor particularly liberal, are on the rise. And so to the extent that the media is critical of that, then they're on the back foot, rather.
Okay, in the remaining minutes that we have, maybe we can focus on something on the entrepreneurial culture of India. Where do you, if you were to advise us to kind of focus our attentions, and we look at India as it develops on its trajectory, you say it might be the tortoise, but might be the hare, as it were. What would you have us focus on in terms of the business community, in terms of where wealth is being generated and jobs are being generated?
I mean, I think India has a bright story to tell. That there has always been, it's a big and complicated country, and so there have always been different stories. You have successes, particularly in areas like technology, research and development sectors, like, I mean, traditionally IT outsourcing. Now there's a booming startup culture in areas like digital payments, in cities like Bangalore and Hyderabad, but you also have some manufacturing success stories, parts of the automotive supply chain, generic pharmaceuticals. So there's large chunks of the Indian economy which are globally productive and quite impressive. The problem is that the level of productivity hasn't filtered through to other areas, and so you still have other areas that are much more closely tied to government, have greater problems of governance failure or crony capitalism. And so one of the challenges for India is to take the best of its economy, which is world class, particularly in the private sector, and to try and make that filter through to the rest of the economy as a whole.
So you are optimistic, I gather, about India's success in the future? Do you see anything that might derail it?
Oh, I mean, I see lots of things. I think India has a huge range of challenges. And to become a rich country by the middle or second half of this century, India has an awful lot of work to do. We haven't talked about urbanization. It's a massive challenge. 200, 300 million people are going to move from Indian villages to towns and cities in the next 20 or 30 years. Climate change, water, huge challenges which require very wise public policy. But I think, in a sense, India has some advantages. It has very intelligent people. It has a reasonably robust and stable system of government. And if its policymakers make good decisions, then although India's trajectory is rocky in the short term, I think there are reasons to be reasonably optimistic in the long term.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to James Crabtree, the author of The Billionaire Raj. He's here in Kuala Lumpur. That's all we have for you for Consider This. I'm Sharad Kutan, only for Astro Awani.